challenging stereotypes as to women who rap, attributing the following reasons to women's inability to attain commercial success. This is like the original article is kind of arguing that women can't be, you know, popular in rap because, one, women's versions of reality are perceived to be less believable than men. Two, women have tried to be, quote, too hard, either trying to be just like men or trying too hard to be raunchy beyond what people would accept. And three, listeners prefer not to hear aggressive go-for-theirs sentiments from females. And this article kind of talks about the history of rap first, and kind of says that, like, by most accounts, popular or commercial rap began with the release of the 1979 classic Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang. And this was, like, very pure house party music with all the requisite ingredients for dancing the night away. It's catchy, it's apolitical and nonsensical. It's got that bass driven rhythm. The rappers kind of are just battling or in a toasting style that became very like hallmark of early rap, and that kind of became a rap standard because it appealed to everyone that was a partier. And that was kind of the same aesthetic wave as the next wave of rappers like MC Hammer, LL Cool J. And then in the late 1980s and early 1990s, a particular notorious period in popular rap, which was, the article quotes, the so-called quote-unquote gangster era, which the image of the black male as a violent, profane, woman-hating, sex-obsessed criminal was kind of imprinted in popular culture. And this, arguably the genre occasioned more bad press than any other black popular music, but by consequence, not surprisingly, this species of rap is best known to mainstream listeners and is the type that most people identify as representative of all rap, even though that's not true. And it's kind of just the domain of male performers. Like, this article really argues that, like, to be a rapper for so long was, had three immutable truths: that you were black, you were urban, and that you were male. And in this era of, like, quote-unquote gangster rap, it's like Ice Cube, Ice-T, Snoop Dogg, Tupac, not a genre many women rappers were eager to pursue. And the sovereignty of men in rap and the dominance of this style is confirmed in, like, so many, you know, magazines, articles, all that stuff. And then, kind of what I talked about earlier, women kind of really come in hot in the mid-1990s. And this article, or this chapter, I guess, kind of talks about how Lil' Kim's ascendancy as the quote-unquote queen, B-word, because I can't cuss on here, of rap is really intriguing, because she kind of reigned supremely on this throne throughout the late 1990s and early 2000s, bedecked in a hip-hop queen's regalia of minks and boas, dyed in a rainbow of pinks, blues, and greens. Her dominion was not easily attained. Like most women who rap, Lil' Kim has decried hip-hop's misogynist attitudes and longed for a, quote, lot more respect for women. Nevertheless, Kim, more than any other woman in the rap business, has defied its stereotypes and infiltrated areas that very few women have dared. Yeah, like, basically, like, it's talking about how Lil' Kim's mythology is all about, you know, female pleasure. The politics of it, the power of it, the murky mixture of emotions and commerce that, you know, sex has in popular culture. And she has this ability as a shapeshifter, as a black girl, a life-size Barbie doll with a wardrobe of platinum blonde wigs. You know, she's angelic, she's tragic, she's urban, she's, you know, popular. It just kind of confounds this hip-hop world, and it kind of goes with my argument of, like, black women have used rap and the music genre to really just apply their own logic to who they should be. They're like, I can be anybody. You know, like, even to performers today, like, I always think of Nicki Minaj, like, Barbie world. Like, Nicki is Barbie. Like, she can have any hairstyle, she can have any hair color, like, and I know that right now she's a little bit, controversial. I know. I, like, it's tragedy. It's tragedy. I haven't listened to her music in so long, and it's suffer.
Yeah, I miss her.
I miss her. I miss the old her. Yeah, but you were kind of talking about earlier when we were just listening to when I had music on, about talking about language. And this really plays a lot into, you know, female rappers who apply their own respectability politics and irreverence politics into the language that they use, which is fascinating to me. I'm just a language nerd because I am an English major, and I took a class last semester about American Englishes and just like the different dialects that exist in America. Super interesting stuff. But this article talks a lot about the word, the B word. You know the one. It's a female dog. And basically, female rappers starting in this third wave rap really reclaim this word, like, for Black women in specifically, but also just women in general, about, you know, it's colloquial in a way. Like, she is, you know, a queen bee, she's a supreme bee, she'll kill someone for her bee, by any means bee. Like, I'm rich, I'ma stay that bee. Like, and it's the use of the word is in rap is curious and duplicitous. In its broadest sense, the word is used to identify any woman between puberty and menopause and need not refer exclusively to one who is shrill and unpleasant. Not surprisingly, men and women rappers are often at variance in their depiction. In I Ain't the One, for example, Ice Cube tells us that he spells girls with a B. The whining and manipulative B word in this rap uses sex to negotiate monetary favors from Ice Cube, and she implores her girlfriends to take men for, quote, all the money they got. Ice Cube's response to the woman's incessant pestering, "You want lobster? I'm thinking Burger King." A completely different approach to the epithet is taken in MC It's Us a B. Here the usage is not gratuitous, as to so many West Coast raps of the late 1980s and early 1990s. The rapper has been hurt by the song title's subject, a money-grabbing schemer, and he uses the term B to vent his anger towards the woman who has used him badly. He even defines B for us, explaining, "I calls you a B," in other words, a teaser. Biggie uses the term lovingly in Me and My Bee, which is a bizarrely touching tribute to his main girl. Rapping a, quote, a real bee is what I want, Biggie enumerates the admirable qualities of this woman, someone who never snitches, who is dependable and trustworthy, and who understands that her man will beat her if she misbehaves, which is crazy, but okay. By contrast, the bee word in women's rap is usually not an epithet. It's a term of endearment, a weapon of empowerment, and a means of creating a sisterhood among kindred souls. As such, the word is transformed into a tangible expression of self-affirmation and worn like a regent's crown. The term, as found in women's rap, typically defines a homegirl, a young Black woman between the ages of 14 and 40, it's a really specific time frame, who comes from and identifies with life in, quote, hood. This definition can be narrowed even further to refer to a woman who uses men, who connives, and who obtains Luke are using whatever means are at her disposal. Importantly, there is widespread and tacit approval among women rappers that this behavior is acceptable, that women, like men, can be low-down players and hustlers. Rapper DeBrat opens All My Bees with the attention-getting question command to rally, "Where my bees at? Where is all my bees at?" And this rap about money and materialism, it's actually more about the necessity for women to be financially independent. The sisterly camaraderie is as palpable as the utter contempt for men. This article is really interesting, but it's kind of talking about how, you know, Black female artists in the music scene have just reclaimed these terms that have been used against them by men for so long. And I think the B word is a really interesting example because it has just evolved so much in the past 30 or so years to, you know, it has so many meanings. And that's, you know, what I love about, I guess, the English language is just like one word can be used contextually in so many different ways. Like, I'm sure, like, I don't know, like with your friends, like, I mean, I don't really walk into a room and I'm like, "What's up, my bees?" But like the B word is like, it can be used in so many different contexts, and
it all really depends on the tone.
It depends on the tone,
the inflection of your voice.
Yeah, because it's like, and it's just so, because you can be like, "Oh, like that's my bee," or you can be like, "That girl's a bee." Like,
exactly.
There's just like so many different ways, and I just really like that. This idea that, you know, feeding into respectability politics, it's like so many males, rappers, and just men in general have called us this word for so long, like, we're going to take it back. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, like, maybe I am this, but it actually doesn't mean what you think it means. And I think that's interesting. But we're going to play Queen Bee by Lil' Kim because that feeds into the language aspect. And then we're going to play Love on the Brain by Rihanna because we both love this song. And we were talking about kind of just, you know, this feeds into the politics of it all, about these double standards for women and men in all situations, where, you know, I think a lot of female artists get canceled for the smallest things, but men can do anything. We were talking about how Chris Brown hit Rihanna. Like, it was a big thing.
It was such a big thing. It was shown on every single news platform, yet his concerts still get sold out.
He's still performing.
People still wear his merch just around.
Yeah. And just, like, that double standard, kind of in the same way where it's, like, we were talking about, you know, Kamala Harris versus Trump.
Yeah. Or Janet Jackson.
Yeah.
And during her Super Bowl, her career ended.
Yes.
Because of something a man did.
Yeah.
I sometimes I really can't fathom how that works.
Yeah.
I feel like just the pop culture space in general is kind of.
And, like, God forbid someone have a nip slip. Like,
yeah. God forbid.
God forbid.
God forbid.
You put her up there in that costume. And, like,
and if I had to choose between a nip slip or beating somebody to a pulp.
Yeah.
Guess which one I'm picking.
Exactly. Yeah. So we're going to play that. And then we're going to play No Scrubs by TLC, which is kind of going to go into, we can both kind of talk about relationship dynamics and how that kind of feeds into both of our topics. But I just also really want to listen to No Scrubs by TLC first. But yeah, I hope you enjoy these three and we'll see you guys in a little bit.
you've let go. What you want from me?
What you want from me?
And try to buy your pretty heart with a price too high. Baby, you got me let go. You love when I fall apart.
Fall apart.
So you can put me together and throw me against the wall. Don't you stop loving me, don't quit loving me, just stop loving me. Oh, and babe, I'm fist fighting with fire just to get close to you. Could we burn something today? And I'll run for miles just to get a taste. Just to get close to you, could we burn something, babe? And I'll run for miles just to get a taste. Must be love on the brain. That's got me feeling this way. It beats me black and blue, but it fucks me so good and I can't.
Side of his best friend's ride.
Okay, you guys just listened to Queen Bee by Lil' Kim, Love on the Brain by Rihanna, and No Scrubs by TLC. And this is a good transition because CJ is going to chat a little bit about the Black experience of emotion and Black emotion.
And I'm back. Hey, everyone. So I just pulled up this cute little article. It's called Uses of Anger, Love, and Joy, Emotions and Black Resistance. But just to give you a little bit of an overview of what this article is kind of trying to talk about, it's kind of answering the question, or I guess it's just kind of talking about how Black people's expression of anger, love, and joy has long since been criticized, devalued, hovered over, I guess? You know, yeah, the word I'm looking for. And definitely policed by dominant groups. And even through all of that, Black people have found ways to emotionally process, respond to, and resist this harm and violence. So through this article, I'm kind of going to show you or explore how Black people, whether that be individually or collectively, use or don't use anger, love, and joy as practices of resistance against white racial domination. So kind of to get into why emotions even matter, but Black emotions have always been political. Black people's expression of anger, love, and joy has always been a topic for exploitation or just public scrutiny, and has continuously been policed through the dominant groups. I think that it kind of turns into a response to harm and violence when Black people navigate through the cultural, political, and economic impacts of intersecting systems of anti-Blackness, sexism, or homophobia, or like even ableism and other forms of oppression. So Black feminists note that emotions, when used to challenge racism and sexism and other forms of oppression, hold potential to transform lives. Black activists and organizers strategically use or cultivate love, joy, and anger as tactics within their movements. And collectively, this type of work kind of reveals how Black people experience and process and resist oppressive systems. Black sociologists find it necessary to consider what Black feelings tell us about everyday resistance and how people practice agency within the confines of intersecting systems like oppression. So kind of getting into that, radicalized emotions and anti-Black controlling images. I think it's crucial that race scholars have been arguing that anti-Blackness is a foundation of racializing structure that shapes the experience of Black people, situating these racializations as Black in an antagonist relationship to humanity. There are so many institutions and interpersonal interactions that kind of uphold these anti-Blackness, and it dehumanizes and negates Black feelings and emotions while simultaneously humanizing white emotions, putting somebody down to uplift somebody else. There is a race scholar, his name is Bonilla Silva, and he defines racialized emotions as the socially endangered emotions in racialized societies that are group-based and reflect the different positions of actors in racialized societies. And I think that kind of just really points to this white effectiveness that we have going on, where how white people talk, behave, and just present themselves is seen as right. And while the opposite of that, which is how Black people talk, behave, and act, is seen as wrong. foremost, racialized emotions have utility and materiality. I can't freaking talk right now. And inform interactions between racialized groups. Anti-blackness makes black people and their emotions a threat to white racial domination, and it informs white people's institutional or interpersonal responses and strategies used to control, police, and tame black people. For example, white people's fearful responses to mundane black people activities, like black people bird watching or shopping or even renting an Airbnb, and it reinforces and is reinforced by racialized violence of anti-black state. White emotional hegemony constructs racialized emotions in relation to and through one another in a way that keeps white structural dominance in place. I think this white emotional homogamy sustains itself through institutionalized images and stereotypes and just meanings that demonize the emotions of minority communities. We find that black feminists have this concept of controlling images, and they find these very useful. These culturally ingrained stereotypes, they intersect race, gender, class, and sexuality, exalting whiteness as a normative while shifting blame onto black people for systematic oppression rather than addressing its root causes. And we kind of see that today. I mentioned previously a bunch of different black political figures, but I think I want to talk about Miss Crockett first. I think that the way that she goes to present herself, I don't want to say that she's a very emotional person, but I do think that she absolutely wears her emotions on her sleeves. If she has a problem with what's going on, she will be the first to vocalize it. And I think that a lot of people would even call her rude or aggressive due to how she vocalizes these opinions. But I would argue that sometimes the topics that she's addressing or the people she's talking to doesn't command any other emotion from her except for annoyance or anger. And I think that if her white counterparts would show this same type of emotion with somebody that kind of made Miss Crockett feel how she felt, and they were trying to show that through this anger or even aggressiveness, not that I think she's aggressive, but you get what I mean, I think that it would be less scrutinized if it was from a white person than from her. And I guess emotions, or just the bolstering of black emotions, kind of is a tool, or it's used as a tool of white patriarchal supremacy. This thought process is used to control and evolve across generations to fit shifting political, social, and economic contexts, upholding white privilege and denying the full spectrum of emotions that shape black humanity. I remember growing up, I've always been told that I cannot get angry in public. My brothers have been told they can't get angry in public, especially if they have or if they're wearing any dark colors or hoodies. And it's this sort of policing that makes it so hard for black people to live authentically as themselves, which is the entire point of going against respectability politics, because black people should be able to live authentically. And we should also be able to be within all of our emotions. We should have full control and full autonomy for how we choose to react or appreciate, or how we choose to love and hope. And I think that having these sort of stereotypes, or just these types of conflicting talks about how black people are always seen as aggressive, means that we can now never be over the top ever. And that comes with, obviously, joy. That comes with anger. It comes back to even how we're sad. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is something that has limited the Black community with our emotional states. I know there's a lot of Black families in today's age where they still have this restricting feeling towards sadness, especially among the men. And I think that that's a big reason why a lot of Black families have a lot of sons who, I guess, grow up just resenting their fathers. And I think that we all need to move on from this, but it's hard to do so when this white world that we live in has just continued to batter us whenever we want to show any sort of, I guess, backlash to how limited we really are. And I do also think that a lot of Black people in today don't even understand that their emotions have been stifled. Because when you grow up hearing, don't be too loud in public, don't disrupt, don't do this, don't do that, don't feel this, don't feel that, you grow up just feeling like these emotions could never possibly be tailored to you. And I think that Black women in politics today have continued to push back against this limitation on emotions. And I think that through that, we're starting to see that Black people, while we are all of, we are happy, we are full of joy, and we can be angry. And that's okay, because there's a lot to be angry about. But we can also laugh, we can also be kind, and we can be aggressive. But just because we are and these emotions, and because we have big emotions, whether that is negative or positive, doesn't mean we shouldn't show them, because white people have been allowed to show them for several years, and it's always been something that I just guess, you know, we just don't want to be seen as unfriendly or unstable or argumentative or hard to work with, because once those labels hit a Black person, it's kind of over for us. And I think that when it comes to controlling images or just portrayals of Black emotion, it's always been very limiting. And respectability politics kind of goes directly against those limitations. And we do really see that today as politics continues to get more, or at least as politics tries to get more progressive. Okay.
Yeah.
I've rambled enough.
No, that was great. I mean, I think it just, it really does tie all together. I mean, I am a big believer of everything's connected, but yeah, this idea that I think respectability politics is such a broad concept, and it does play into things like how much emotion can I show, because there are these unseen stereotypes, these unseen ideas about Black people that so many, that is in the collective consciousness, that then feed into how, like, they feel that they need to portray themselves, or that they need to, like, not be able to show emotion, or even, like, I don't know if you've read, in high school I read Whistling Vivaldi by Claude Steele. It's about this concept where he kind of, I don't know if it's him or someone else, but it's a Black man. He gives an anecdote about how he says, whenever I'm walking behind a white woman at night, I'll whistle a classical music song, like Vivaldi, because in her mind, that's like, oh, like, he's cultured, like, he's safe, like, he's not gonna hurt me, he's not dangerous, because there is that idea of, like, oh, because I'm a Black man, like, I must be dangerous, like, I'm not just walking home, like, because he was a professor at University of Chicago, or something like that, and so he'd walk home at night, and, like, there'd be, you know, young white students or just white women, and like this idea that you have to whistle Vivaldi, or like, but it does play into just the emotion and feeling as if you can't express that. And I love that you bring up Jasmine Crockett, because I think she deserves a lot of flowers for being someone that wears her heart on her sleeve. And, you know, I think it's not a void argument, but it's a dumb argument to say that, you know, showing anger or emotion in politics is generally looked down upon. And that's a lot of criticism towards women in general in politics. Like, I've heard so many times, like, just guys saying like, oh, we could never have a woman president because like, what if she got too emotional? I was like, okay, and what about our president? Because
thank you.
He's kind of emotional as well.
I just feel like black people, we've been denied.
Yeah.
We've been denied the emotion of anger for mm-hmm. so long.
Yeah.
And I kind of look around and I'm just like wondering, why shouldn't we be angry? Mm-hmm. And not even just whether or not we should be angry. I just feel like understanding black anger and rage as a valid political response to oppression kind of helps people in general understand how black people's anger serves as a catalyst.
Yeah.
Is that the word? Yeah. Like mm-hmm. a catalyst for resistance.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because we've been talking about like taking things back,
mm-hmm.
like the B word.
Yeah.
Or just like our hair.
Yeah.
And like, I would love to take back rage.
Yeah.
I would love to take that back because I don't know. I feel like the second we aren't allowed to feel that, we bottle it up inside.
Yeah.
And then what happens when you do that? Eventually it's going to explode.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I know about that. Yeah. It is like it's interesting that like a debate is who is allowed to feel which emotions.
Yeah.
Because it's like, what do you, like...
What does that mean?
I'm not allowed... Because I am a certain way and there's these certain societal unspoken expectations of how I should act, there's... Like, I'm not allowed to feel angry about something. Like, it is. Like, and, you know, like, it's interesting, too, how we see this in pop culture as well. Like, I'm going to bring up Euphoria. Like, Cassie and Nate, two white characters mm-hmm. on the show. Anytime something happens, Cassie's sobbing. Like, it's like
almost, white woman tears.
It's almost comical at this point. Like, sobbing, sobbing. Like, even Maddie in one of the most recent episodes, like, alludes to meeting up with Cassie by, like, mimicking, like, a crying gesture. Like, guess who I'm going to see? Crying gesture. And Rue, Zendaya's character, is immediately like, oh, Cassie.
Yeah.
And, you know, Nate, too, is known to be this character where, like, when something goes wrong, like, he's going to freak out. Like, he is gonna like male rage, like punch someone, like beat someone up. Like, but it's like these two characters, like, even though they're not well liked characters and we know that they're not great people, they're allowed to do these things. Whereas, like, you know, I think Maddie is not a black woman, but she's a Latina woman on the show, and you know, she is known for this like bad B persona, but like, we never see her cry in front of other people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's not allowed to feel that. And, like, it's just, like, who is allowed to feel what emotions? And
who takes advantage of those emotions exactly. that they are allowed to feel.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's, like, why wouldn't you be allowed to not feel rage for, like, the, like...
Have you ever seen any videos or articles? There's so many videos today of when a Karen comes up to a black person and like... says, oh, I saw you steal something, or like follows them around or just accuses them of some ridiculous thing.
Yeah.
And then they start to cry. Black women have started crying back. They go cry for cry, tear for tear. And I think that is so awesome.
Yeah.
I think that is so great.
That is. Yeah, cry. You're harassing me.
Right.
I'm going to start crying.
Because you're not going to be the victim here.
No.
Not today, lady. So yeah. I think that's really, really
that
awesome.
Is.
And it just, because... I don't know where in our society we decided that tears is enough, just enough to be seen as whoever else that isn't crying means that I'm wrong. But I do think that we're coming to a halt on that pretty quickly.
It's interesting, too, of like, you know, you're talking about, you know, certain groups aren't allowed to feel certain emotions. But to that point, like saying like Karen specifically, like mm-hmm. what groups are allowed to like weaponize those emotions?
Yeah.
Whereas like sadness and tears are like, to me at least, like I'm just a feeler. I'm a Pisces moon. Like, like crying is like cathartic. Like it is important to cry and to like, and I hate crying in front of other people. Like if I start to cry in public, I'm like, I need to go. Like, but like the other day, like I cried in yoga. Just because something in my hips released and I was
really?
Yes. I was like, wow, that was insane. But it's like, you know, people have weaponized tears because it's like, I'm crying, I'm the victim here. Like,
yeah.
Which, yeah, is a whole other thing. But I want to talk about just kind of into these emotions, I guess also, like, Black women have been doing the work in music to kind of chisel away at, I guess, these stereotypes and, like, what they're allowed to feel and what they're allowed to express. And this is from an article I found in the library. It's from a chapter, or it's from a book called Rap Music and Street Consciousness, and it's a chapter titled Daughters of the Blues, Women, Race, and Class Representation in Rap Music Performance. And it kind of talks about how, you know, female musicians, Black female musicians, take on a variety of kind of, like, archetypes of, like, what these kind of different versions of themselves they could be in order to push back against a lot of the stereotypes that are against them in society. And it kind of talks about how, like, I mean, this article really goes into the archetypes. They label them as, like, queen mother, fly girl, sister with attitude. They even go into, like, the lesbian, all these things. Like, but it's kind of just talking about how females as artists in a male-dominated tradition are redefining women's culture and identity from a Black feminist perspective by just being, like, this is, you know, the character I'm choosing to be and performing to be, and this is a version of a Black woman that you may not have seen before but does exist. And, you know, some women of rap still face overt sexism regarding their creative capabilities. I think women just in general do, but it's such a interesting representation of what a female can look like or what a woman can look like, because a lot of, like, the work that's being done in the research area is focusing on, like, attitudes and responses to, like, sexual objectification, but it ignores, like, the political roles and how, like, Black women rappers are in dialogue with one another, they're in dialogue with Black men, they're in dialogue with Black women, and just dominant American culture as they struggle to define themselves. And they convey their views on a variety of issues concerning identity, sociohistory, esoteric beliefs, shared by a lot of young African-American women. And female rappers specifically have attained this sense of distinction through revising and reclaiming history, reclaiming destiny, reclaiming emotion, kind of like what you were talking about, being like, I'm angry about this and I'm going to express it. I'm sad about this, I'm going to express it. Even, like, something as, like, so universally, you know, so universally felt as heartbreak is something that at least I've noticed. Like, I'm like, I can name a million songs by white women about what it feels like to have their heart broken and how it's awful and, like, it's the worst thing ever to happen. But, like, when I think about, you know, a lot of, like, it's, I think it's harder sometimes for Black women to express that sentiment. But, like, the stuff that they do write is also, like, I'm, like, trying to think of what I'm trying to say. It's also just as, like, universally, like, felt. Like, I think of, like, a lot of, like, SZA's songs, like, you know, like, from that first album Control, like, about, like, feeling like I'm never picked and, like, this mm-hmm. is why. Or even, like, you know, just, like, who is allowed to feel what. Like, I feel like it's so easy for a white female artist to write a breakup album, and they're doing it well. Like, I love Olivia Rodrigo, I love Sabrina Carpenter, like, I love Taylor, all these artists. But it's like, you know, when I think when a Black woman does it, it's not taken as seriously. Like, it's,
exactly.
It's like, oh, like, you need to get over it because you're, you know,
move on.
Like, this kind of pushed on stereotype of, like, you're an independent woman, like, you're mm-hmm. fine. But it's like, no, like, Megan Thee Stallion was crying on stage 2 weeks ago, like, over Klay Thompson, and like, she's allowed to feel that. Like,
exactly.
She got cheated on. Like, yeah.
But and she makes an album about that, and all of a sudden, she's a B word.
I know, or exactly.
She wants attention, or yeah. just anything along those lines.
So it's like creating spaces for themselves through music that, like, aren't even, like, you know, it doesn't have to be this, like, whole, you know, like, push for, like, I'm independent, like, all this stuff, and, like, you know, this kind of girl boss, like, era that I think this wave of feminism is. Like, it's also something as simple and like dating back to those early musicians that we talked about, like Nina Simone, who are doing the pieces of work that don't seem radical but are in a greater space. Like, even just a work of like, I'm sad, I'm a sad girl, and like, this is why. Like, I know, like, SZA off of her last album, oh my god, I'm blanking, SOS, off of SOS, like, had a song with Phoebe Bridgers on it, who was probably like queen sad white woman.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that song Ghost in the Machine is really sad. I love that song. But it's like, what are we allowed to feel? Maybe I'll play that song. But like, yeah, it's just kind of like rappers and artists in general are just doing so much work to kind of reclaim these emotions. And I implore, I guess, the listeners to, I'm such a lyrics person, but like, when you're listening to music, like, really listen to the lyrics, because at the end of the day, like, all these artists are writers. Like, they're trying to tell you something.
Yeah.
And whether that be like in a song that feels very like vulgar and like stuff like that, like, there's still these messages.
Before we get into music, I just want to read one more thing from this article. A large body of scholarship illustrates the everyday strategy of respectability politics that Black individuals adopt to navigate racialized institutions and mitigate being perceived as angry, incompetent, or unruly, which are the big three stereotypes that Black people get whenever they have big emotions. Some have instead adopted so-called respectable behaviors, like maintaining a stoic, emotionally controlled public persona or cool pose. I know you guys love to see, but Black men, sometimes when they're outside, you will not catch them smiling. And that's just because in Black culture, at least, like, just showing any type of emotion can be seen as either, you could be seen as angry, maybe just for baring your teeth, or even weak. Excessive smiling and artificial pleasantries to avoid confrontation and minimizing the use of African American vernacular, or AAVE. For example, Black women in fields like engineering, law, and politics reveal that they cannot contain, that they contain anger by adopting smiles and other responses that allow them to appear competent and resist being perceived as an excessive, or as seen as excessive or angry. I just think that when it comes to Black people's emotions, at the end of the day, we're limiting ourselves because of how we're perceived. And so with that, let's go ahead and get into the music.
Yeah.
Really think about that while you're listening to this next song.
Yeah. So we're going to listen to three songs because we are actually almost out of time. We'll go a few minutes over just because we started like 5 minutes late. But we're going to play Ghost in the Machine because I was just talking about that. And SZA, like, she's an artist, but like, there's so many combos now. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like, who? And then we're going to listen to Young Women's Blues by Bessie Smith, which was referenced in one of the articles that I was reading, which that'll just show up in my write-up. But it's the lyrics in there are really, really good. And then we're going to listen to I'll Be by Foxy Brown and Jay-Z because I wanted to get Foxy Brown in here. But yeah, we're going to listen to these three, and then we'll be back.
Conversation is so boring. Heard about what? I hate her. I don't agree. I did it first. I give a fuck. I just want fuck. Eat, sleep, love. Happy, can you make me happy? Can you keep me happy? Can you distract me from all the disaster? Can you touch on me and knock on me after? Can you hate on me and mask it with laughter? Can you lead me to the arc? What's the password? I need you, man. All that God like you forget how to love somebody. I, everybody.
about AI. Robot got more heart than I. Robot got future, I don't. Robot can't sleep, but I don't. Power down, I'm wide open, I'm awake. I'm on autopilot, I'm out of my mind. And I'm wide open, can you distract me from all the disaster? Can you touch on me and not call me after? Can you hit on me and mask it with laughter? Can you lead me to the app? What's the password?
Run these browns down, see that long, lonesome road. Yeah.
Nana. Uh-huh. Come on.
With a pop, brace yourself as I ride on top. Close your eyes as you ride, right out your socks. Donald loses his mind as he grind in the tunnel. Wanna give me the cash he made off his last bundle? Nasty girl, won't pass me the world. I push the beat, not the backseat girl. Don't deep throat the seed, no, she floats. Murder she wrote and keeps the heat close. Firm nigga, we post to be the illest on three coasts. Familiar, bigger than egos. Y'all Danny DeVito, small niggas. All I see is the penny ethers, that's all nigga. No shark in this year, raise the bigger. 15% make the whole world sit up and take notice. Now I take over, y'all take quotas. Bye bye.
Get up the bitch, y'all. We drop hits. Now tell me, how nasty can you get? All the way from the hood to your neck of the woods rip. One thing for sure. That's right, we drop hits. Tell me, how nasty can you get? All the way from the hood to your neck of the woods is rip. One thing for sure.
I'm too loud, nasty as I wanna be.
And don't shake your sassy ass in front of me. Before I take it there and tear your back out.
That shit ain't happened since the map was out. Lola Falana, dripped in Gabbana. 90 style, the finest style. Round the waist to fit, wanna taste the shit? Put me on a bass and throw your face in it. Fuck Nah, nah, y'all can't touch her. My sex drive all night like a trucker. Let alone the skills I possess. And y'all gon' see by these mills I possess. Never settle for less, I'm in excess. Not inexpensive, EVS to the till. That's just the way I'm built. Nasty, world class, still.
Get out the gate, y'all, we drop hits. Now tell me, how nasty can you get? All the way from the hood to your neck of the woods is ripped. One thing for sure. That's right, we drop hits. Tell me, how nasty can you get? All the way from the hood to your neck of the woods is ripped. One thing for sure.
You can hold what I got, roll with the rock. Propeller capo when the candy apple drop. Will tears fall in your ears if I don't stop? Can you throw it like a quarterback third in the lot?
Dig me, I get you locked like Biggie with Herb in the spot. Word midi, the cop and the kitty. I'm the bomb, Biggie, Panana, sexy brown thing. Madame, y'all, make them turn over from the full court pressure. The undress you and shit all over your asses. I ain't playing, knock it out at the wins. I'm saying, what's the sense in delaying? I'm trying to run G from the P to the AM. I saw your little thing, now I'm swaying, okay then.
Straight out the gate, y'all, we drop hits. Now tell me, how nasty can you get? All the way from the hood to your neck.